Good evening.
Hello.
That Darlene?
Yes.
So how are you this evening?
Pretty good. How are you?
Doing very well. Except I got something that was 70 degrees yesterday afternoon till 29 today. Other than that, we had
Do we have some additional students tonight?
There should be three of you, looks like, for the class.
Oh!
Yeah. Hi, who just joined us?
Cleveland.
Hey, Cleveland, how are you this evening?
I'm doing good, Dave. How are you?
I was just telling Darlene here that other than the fact that the weather went from 70 degrees yesterday to 29 today, other than that, I'm doing fine.
Oh, wow.
Colorado has unusual weather patterns, and they always have.
Yes.
So, yes. You know, in January, I may shovel snow one day and play golf 2 days later.
Yeah. It's
really unusual, and I don't like winter. I live in Colorado. But here, it'll snow, and it'll melt, and I know, even though I hate winter, I know we need the snow because that's where our water comes from. So we need a lot of snow this year. We had very little last year. We're looking for hopefully a lot of snow. And then when it snows, I just leave town.
Wow.
I literally look at the schedule and say, oh, big snowstorm blowing in. Where are the cheap places that are warm? Oh, it's cheap to go to, you know, Las Vegas, we're cheap to go to Dallas, we're cheap to go to Atlanta, and I just book, and I just go.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's kind of the way, and my wife is, she's okay with this. She says, I know you hate winter. If you want to go away, it's okay. So I go away about once a month.
Yeah.
In the winter months, and just go someplace where it's warm. Hi, who just joined us?
Hello, Dave, this is Marlene. How are you?
I am fine, Marlene. How are you this evening?
Great, thanks. Glad to be able to join you this week.
Good to have you here. So I have Marlene, Darlene, and Cleveland.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of the way it works here. All right. So welcome back. This is our second session. Marlene, did you listen to the first session audio recording?
Yes, I did.
Okay. So for any of you out of that first set of recordings, anything for the class of recording that you have a burning question about before we get into discussion for tonight?
No.
No burning questions?
No burning
question for me.
I can fix that. So did you guys all get the copy of the slides for tonight's discussion?
Yes.
Yes, thank you.
All right, good. So let's just start with a quick review of our first session. We talked about the history of DISC, how we trace its modern roots back to Dr. William Moulton Marston and his book, The Emotions of Normal People. He created the theory behind the DISC, if you will, but not the actual assessment. That was done in 1972 by some PhDs at the University of Minnesota. And those two guys created it together, and they later split apart into two different companies. One of them is called Carlson Learning, which today is traced to a company called Wiley, which is a company that we're using and that I use. The other group is called Target Trade International, commonly referred to as TTI. But they are also a direct descendant, if you will, of the original DISC assessments. The other ones you see out there, whatever they call them, a version of DISC, or they look at them as colors or animals or birds, those are all kind of DISC knockoffs. Not to say they don't have any value, but you know, we're the original. And we're also the ones who are still working hard every day to enhance and develop this to be even more powerful. We talked about, you know, the importance of what DISC does, and we'll talk about that a lot more, especially starting tonight. But also important to understand the things that DISC does not measure. So DISC is never intended to be a tool that suddenly encapsulates your entire life into four easy boxes, or, we'll discover later, 12 easy boxes. It's not that way, and it shouldn't be viewed that way. It's a tool to help you understand yourself, help you understand others around you. A lot of things DISC does not measure. It's like intelligence, desire, values, strength of your character, emotional intelligence. You're going to find that DISC and EQ are very closely related. People I know who do a lot of EQ work oftentimes start with DISC as a baseline, because if you know about the basics of EQ, know yourself, manage yourself, know others, interact with others, it's the same concept behind DISC. DISC lets you know yourself, know your strengths, know your challenges, and then adjust to those things and manage those things. Identify others, and identify what they need from you to be successful. So you're going to find that DISC and EQ play very closely together. Talk about the four primary DISC styles, basically, real quickly, D, I, S, and C. I also showed you that there are really 12 different versions of the DISC. And while some people still certainly are a pure D, a pure I, a pure S, or a pure C as their primary, we all have all four of those things inside of us in varying degrees. And so we want to make sure the DISC is a great place to start, the foundational piece. The DISC goes much deeper than that. Talk about the Johari window, the fact that the goal of coaching and the goal of DISC is to help move things into the arena, the area that we both know, with ourselves and our clients, or the client people around them. The more things we reveal to each other, the easier to get along and communicate. So we talked about the arena, the mask, the blind spots, and the potential. The key for the coach, of course, is increasing the arena by reducing the blind spots. And we talked about that brief intro to the behavioral style chart. And again, the idea of if you can begin to learn to draw that versus having a really pretty picture, because I told you about that last week, when I had really pretty pictures, I thought they were really impressive, but no one cared, so I started drawing them by hand on the back of napkins, and then people got excited about them. So pretty picture, be able to draw it, very valuable to you. All right, questions so far?
No.
Or comments? All right. A brief look at the behavioral style chart, which we talked about again last week. Again, they show the four quadrants, the D, the I, the S, and the C. And, of course, the whole basis of the style charts is the fact that we can compare certain types of things people have in common. A more active, fast-paced, assertive view of life, if you will, versus the reserved, moderate-paced, thoughtful. And those people who are people-oriented, accepting of others more readily, and agreeable, versus those who tend to be task-oriented, questioning, and skeptical. And that's the basics of the style chart. And the reason the chart is round is because it really is a continuum. You talk about your primary style, you're going to see other styles engaged there as well, as you've seen in your profiles. But having this now done as a circle versus the older style of the graphs shows you how these things are interrelated more and not really separate. That's the intention of having it round. But you'll also notice that the D and the S are opposite of each other. While the D is, you know, active, fast-paced, task-oriented, skeptical, the S is more thoughtful and reserved and agreeable and people-oriented. As you might guess, that can sometimes cause conflict, or sometimes not. Talk about that tonight. Likewise, the I and the C are opposites. The I being, again, active, fast-paced, people-oriented, accepting, and the C being, again, that thoughtful, reserved, but also task-oriented, and questioning. So those styles are opposites as well, and they also can easily come into conflict because they have different perspectives of the world around them. And hopefully you guys have seen very clearly here how we can overlay Marshall's visual model on this and see the same kind of context to it. Because the original model from Marshall and this model, while they're not identical, they certainly align very closely together. So, are you guys ready to talk about the high D tonight?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. So, we've got, you know, a couple of high, at least one high D in the group here, so we're not going to single anybody out. We're going to talk about the high Ds, though, and all this, the styles here in terms of how they interact with the world around them and how they are at their very best and how they are at their very worst. Learn to recognize, you can't giggle, we learn to recognize that high D and their natural emotions and fears and how they tend to communicate. So if you have that behavioral style chart, you want to keep it someplace, you know, handy so you can look at it readily. Because you know that D is on that upper end of that scale, right?
Yes.
So at their best, you know, they're confident and they're self-assured. High Ds tend to be natural leaders. They enjoy leadership. They will seek it out or sometimes just assume leadership. They're always willing to take the hill, to charge the hill and say, let's just get this done. They tend to be adventurous. They get bored pretty easily. And if things get too routine, they want to change things around.
Yeah.
Sometimes they'll change things just because, well, change is good. They like change. Change is part of their natural makeup, and if they think they can find a better way or even a possibility of a better way, they are likely to start changing things. Now, that can be disconcerting to people around them.
Yeah.
They look at that as just a way to make things better, and who doesn't want things that are better?
Dave?
Yes?
Is that like when companies or school districts look for a change agent?
Sorry, say it again, please.
When companies or a school district look for a change agent to go into a school and clean it out.
Yeah.
And if a person isn't aware of this and isn't aware of the other components of behavior and styles to the degree that I think this helps to describe it, you end up with burnout. You end up with terrible conflict because you drive the car too fast and you don't bring the passengers with you.
So when you mentioned school districts, yes, but also organizations. When things tend to get really bad and they say, oh my gosh, this area is a disaster, it needs to be fixed, they knowingly or unknowingly call upon the high D.
Yeah.
The person who's going to make change, drive things to a different direction, and do it quickly to make things happen. Now, if that high D is not emotionally aware, they may be leading the charge of people who don't want to follow them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Now, of course, there are always ways around this. Okay. But when you're looking to make change, you're saying to yourself, can I find, you know, who's a change agent? Well, that equates back to the high D very readily. To the high I also, to an extent. But the D is going to drive to make change in a hurry and, if you will, right the ship. In an emergency, they call the high D because they're going to make it happen. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Can it be painful? Absolutely.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a minute here, actually. So high Ds tend to be inquisitive, but oftentimes when they'll ask questions, they'll think they already know the answer and expect you to agree with them. And in a hurry, they, if you disagree with them, they may run over you. When they're not in such a hurry, they may be really curious about your response and listen to your response and even change their mind. These are actually pretty malleable when presented with new information. They think they're right. You say, no, you're not right. Here's why. They go, oh, I didn't know that. Okay. And they'll just change their mind. They're fine with that. Others may get confused by that, but they go, oh, okay, I didn't know that. And they'll change. So let me give you an example here of a high D behavioral style individual. And this is one who's working at the best of the high D, okay? So at the best, Sam is a fast-rising executive in a large multinational company. He has a reputation as someone who gets things done and gets results. He's always looking for a better way to do things, and oftentimes he finds them. Now, Sam surrounds himself with people who are also talented, take-charge types. He delegates to them because he trusts them and knows they'll get things done as well. So if Sam's your coaching client, and his challenge is his support from the executive team is a little bit thin because while his results have been outstanding, he has not done a good job of building relationships other than those with his immediate superiors.
Mm-hmm.
Other executives don't believe they truly know Sam, and therefore they're willing to risk themselves reputations to promote him because they don't just know enough. And that's why Sam might come to you for coaching. A highly effective D, getting things done, but tends to not build relationships with people who are not in his immediate area of concentration. So do you know someone like Sam who might be a high D? Are we nodding our heads or are we shaking our heads? I can't tell.
I'm shaking my head. Darlene, I'm shaking my head.
And why are you shaking your head?
Because I think I was a high D.
Oh, okay.
And they used to tell me that I didn't make relationships and didn't build relationships with certain people. And that's what my staff used to tell me. So I used to have to make sure that I had certain people who were in my court with me that would remind me and would purposely and intentionally develop agendas where I would interact with certain groups during small group discussions and activities.
Yeah, that sounds like classic Heidi, right? And when someone told you, she said, oh, I wasn't aware, try and compensate. Yeah. So that's the way high Ds tend to operate, operating, you know, if you will, at their best. And at their best, they can be phenomenal leaders that people get behind because they see the boss is going to go to bat for them. The boss is going to make some things happen, and they'll really support that boss. And the boss tends to have a good rapport with people below them and around them, but just in that immediate circle. It doesn't stretch out. They don't build what I'll call the political allies they should build an organization. Okay? So now, that's kind of the high D at their best. Let's look at the high D at their worst.
Yes.
Now, at the worst, the D might appear to be aloof or arrogant.
Yeah.
They make demands of their subordinates, don't recognize good performance, they find fault, and they seldom give praise. They're big proponents of change, and they believe they know better than those around them, therefore they make their decisions unilaterally. They can appear to be cold and insensitive. They tend to communicate in loud, short bursts, and so they take time to explain their decisions, and they don't get buy-in. Same behavioral style, different perspective. So your client comes to you, Susie. Susie's the VP at a mid-sized company. She's in charge of operations and views it as her personal kingdom. She came in from the outside with a resume that demonstrates one crown achievement after another. Her old company refused to promote her. She's a problem solver, moves from one problem area to another, finding like a tornado, eliminating underperformers and deadwood, improves the bottom line, and then moves on to the next challenge. Team below her lacks talent. Her successes can almost always be attributed to her strong will and determination. Her challenge, she's worn out her welcome at her current company. A number of key employees have left the organization. There's no place else for her to go in this company at her level, and she believes she's being underutilized. Now, I got that client right now. Her name isn't Susie, but I got that very same client. She comes in, she shakes things up. She thinks she's been underutilized. She's annoying people around her. Her people are leaving. And I'm trying to coach her through all that. So you can see here, these are both the high D styles. One's utilizing their style to their advantage, and one to their disadvantage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, would you want to have a high D client? They're all quiet.
Well, Dave, with me being a C, I know a high D would give me a big challenge and would really test the waters with me, but I would try my best to help the high D because I'm the patient one and the understanding one and the one that will listen and to get them to talk about what's really going on with them, you know, and they tend to be, I know a high D, and with me being a C, I have to step back sometimes and let them have their time to dish out their frustrations and then come back and make a comment. But I would welcome the challenge of coaching a high D.
Okay. What's the advantage of a high D client?
Well, the advantage of a high D client. You can
is a high D client wants results, wants to move on, wants answers.
Yeah, exactly. They like change. If you convince them that they need to change, they are all on board. You heard Darlene talk about it earlier. People tell her she needs something different. She's going like, okay, how do I take care of this? So, yeah. Big plus of a high D client is that once you can convince them that they need to change, if they're with a coach, they likely do believe that to some level. Therefore, they can be easy to coach in terms of they want it. They want to know what's wrong so they can fix it. The challenge of a high D client is that they were sent to you because their boss said you need to get a coach and they don't believe they need it.
Yeah.
Every call becomes a challenge.
Yeah.
So, as we move forward here, talk about the high D some more, the reality is, Cleveland mentioned he's a high C coach. Well, what if you're a high D and you're a coach? So, there are some natural tendencies of a high D as a coach. They can be too direct and therefore off-putting. They can miss the emotional undertones because they're focused on the tasks and the results. They may try and force someone into that shift before they're ready for it because the coach is ready, therefore the client must be ready, except the client's not. They can focus too much on tasks and actions. As we all know from our coaching classes, people pay us not for the result of the task, but for the result of the coachable moment. What's underneath this? When they can solve that and solve their own problems, that's why they really need the coach. The high D tendency is to give advice, so they may want to give advice all the time. And as an accountability partner, they just assume people are getting things done because, well, they would. And so they may not check in as that accountability partner. So if you're a high D and you're a coach, you got to watch for these things, your natural tendencies. Now, can high D be a good coach?
Yes.
Be a great coach. Do you know what they're going to do?
Results.
Make sure you take that. They're going to get results. They're going to make sure you take action. If they are aware of their tendencies, understand the basics of the, I should say, the subtleties of coaching, they could be phenomenal coaches. So about the high D as a client. Well, as a, they have some natural strengths. Again, they're action-oriented, okay? So they want to change. They want to make things better. And I mentioned before, they don't worry about mistakes. When a high D makes a mistake and you point out, go, that's a mistake, here's why, they go, oh, okay, and they move on. They don't tend to dwell on the mistakes. They have blind spots, though, and because they can be very well-intentioned, they may not be aware of how others perceive them.
Yeah.
Which before they come across as arrogant and aloof or too brash, they may not be aware of that. They're not generally tuned into the emotions of people around them. So as a coach of the high D, things you're going to be looking for, especially around those blind spots, are they aware of how others see them? They see themselves quite clearly, and they sure others see them as well. There's an old saying here that applies all throughout this, but especially to the Ds, and that is we tend to judge others based on their action. We tend to judge ourselves based on our intent. Now, that applies especially to the high Ds who can have their heart in the very best place. But you saw in your reading, they tend to communicate in short bursts. They tend not to explain things. They tend to assume people know where they're going, and therefore it can leave people around them confused.
Yeah. Oh.
Dave, this is Marlene, and a question that I have for you is that you mentioned that you have a D client. Can you give an example of a coaching session topic that you had, what the content was or the agenda was and how you coached through it? Is it possible to just give a brief example of that?
Sure, because we had a session last week, and she came in, and her boss is actually a very high C. Her boss is the CEO. Now, that's fairly unusual. What that means is, we'll talk about the C, you'll see this, the high C tends to be very deliberate and process-oriented and focused on what can go wrong. And the D is focused on, what can I do next? How can I improve things? How can I get this off my plate so I can go on to the next thing? And we coached around the idea of communication with her boss. Because as she's telling me, she says, my boss doesn't understand me. He's holding me back from being successful. So the coaching was around this communication, and the aha moment was, my boss doesn't understand me. Wait a minute. I don't understand my boss and what he's looking for. And how can I satisfy his needs so he can satisfy mine?
But you didn't know her boss, right? You were just basing that coaching session, in essence, on an assumption that she stated, my boss doesn't understand me.
Well, I had talked to her boss before I began coaching her.
Okay, so you had some idea as to who she was talking about.
Yeah, and we talked for 45 minutes, so I knew he was a high C 5 minutes into it.
Okay.
And when, in this case, this particular client has asked for a DISC profile. I don't require it, but a lot of times people ask for it because they know of my background. And as we talked about her boss, and, the profile that describes different behavioral styles. And I said, which one is your boss? Because he's got to be a high C. Okay. So if you're a D and he's a C, this all led to the issue of, again, the question moment of, he doesn't understand me. I don't understand him. I need to figure out what he needs because he is the boss and give it to him. Does that help?
Yeah. I mean, it's great to hear a coaching session because I tried using assessments early on in my coaching practice, and I really didn't care for them, which is why I'm open to listening to this program, and they are kind of all similar. I know there was an author, Florence Littauer, who kind of described to you different characteristics of people so that you could have some idea as to who you were dealing with. So I tried to use assessments, and I found one of two things happening, which is what caused me to get away from them. And the one of two things happened was that they either focused on the assessment and talking about it and referencing it, and it was always the focus of that profile. And they either supported it or they argued it. And I said, oh, my gosh, this is like sabotaging my coaching session every time. I don't want to use it as a reference. I want them to have a deeper understanding of who they are and have those aha or those epiphany moments because of a breakthrough that they had. And so I got away from the assessments and just used curious questions and creative conversation for them to have more results-oriented during each session. Just based on a conversation and helping them uncover and answer things for themselves, so to speak.
Right.
I'm trying to really wrap my head around how the profile would not sabotage my coaching sessions as they have in the past by always referencing it.
Right.
because I want them to have a better understanding of who they are and how they relate in the world.
And that's what you're trying to do here. And yeah. The idea of a DISC or other assessments is to give you that language to use that is a common language that is also not one that is confrontational. So you can call those things to their attention. But if any assessment becomes the centerpiece of everything they're doing, they have a problem. And because that's not healthy.
Exactly. And I didn't want to hand them that because of them hanging their hat on it and always being a part of the conversation. And I think it lost focus as to helping them to uncover or chisel away at who they were and who and what world they were living in, whether it be work, whether it be personal with family, friends, whatever. And I just got away from assessments and just had creative conversation, curious questioning, and then just all these aha moments just were awesome just in having good conversation and good questioning going on.
Yeah. Well, and the goal of our discussion here in this kind of a class is less focus on the actual assessment and more on how do you coach around the assessment.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we talked here about, you know, some things that the D has as a natural blind spot. If you know that your client has a D, you know they are not aware of how others perceive them. It's a very common blind spot. That allows you to craft questions that will fit that kind of style. So if you skip ahead, the questions to ask the high D, you ask them, what are you going to do? They love that kind of question. They're going to jump at that because they like to do things. When you ask them, how will this impact others, that's going to stop them in their tracks because they're not thinking about it.
Yeah.
And that's where having that, that's where knowing what they are is important. Okay? They also tend to get singularly focused on the result. So if you ask them, are there other alternatives, that's also going to stop in the tracks and make them think, wait a minute, what else is there here? What you need is as a result, a question that gets them back on track and back into their D and looking ahead. And when can you do this? Again, results-oriented. With a D, you've got to watch, make sure they don't sit there and say, I'll do it tomorrow. Really, is that the right time frame for this? Is it maybe that exactly is the wrong time frame for this? So asking the when question helps you see if they're going to try and rush it through or do it the right way. Does that help you, Marlene?
Yes, and I guess I still just have reservation, but I'm open to the potential of this. I guess my coaching comes from not how do I want to say this? It's just like being in the moment with your coaching session, really paying attention to what they're saying and answering a question with a question to keep them driving, to keep them thinking. I know many of my clients feel like they've been hypnotized through the whole session because I just keep them going until they have a breaking point. And sometimes that happens within a very short period of time, within 15 minutes to a half hour, and sometimes it's close to that 45-minute session. But I've never had anything like this to reference to give them the answer. I don't want to give them the answer. I want them to discover the answer. I want them to, you know, be in that situation and assess everything that's going on. And then when they ask me, they go, Marlene, well, what do you think? And I go, it's not about me. It's about you. Because the minute I give them my opinion or my answer, now they're either defending me or arguing with me. And I learned that very early on that I don't give my opinion and I don't give suggestions. I say it's all about you. I don't want to sabotage our coaching session. So I learned very early on just the art of asking questions that are appropriate But to keep that client in that upper level of thinking that improves their chances of having that breakthrough. And I haven't had assessments work for me in the sense that if I mentioned it, it kind of threw them out of that concentration range or rounds or whatever. So that's where I'm trying to figure out how I can implement this into my current coaching practice without losing the momentum that I have with curious questioning and creative conversation and keeping that client going.
Yeah. Well, I think you want to have those things be connected, because if your questions, and they probably do this somewhat naturally, if your questions are matching the client's behavioral style, they're more impactful. Let's talk about the different styles. So you're going to see different kinds of questions that are being asked, and the right question for the right style can have more impact than the right question, if you will, for the wrong style.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Excuse me, Dave.
Yeah.
Dave, you were talking about the questions to ask the high D. Questions
right.
to ask the high D. You got to the third question. Are there other alternatives? There's two other questions there. What do you need as a
result?
Oh.
Yeah.
And then the fifth question.
When can you do this?
Okay.
You want to know exactly, you want to know if they're going to try and rush it through, which is a tendency of a high D, or lay the groundwork and do it the right way so the people around them are in conjunction with them.
See, have you ever heard of Bloom's taxonomy?
Yeah.
And the different high-order, low-order questions and the different styles of developing questions and asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
And how to scaffold the questions. That's what I'm looking at, is how do you scaffold the questions, or know which level questions to ask which high D, high I. That's what I'm really thinking about.
Yeah. Okay. You're asking the questions that. And the questions are going to sound more natural to you based on your style. You have to be aware of your style, therefore your tendencies, to which questions to ask, the tendency for the client. If I am, for example, a high D coach, and I'm coaching a high S behavioral style, my natural questions won't fit their natural behavioral style. But if I know that my tendencies, I can adjust that for who they are and coach them where they are instead of where I am.
That's a challenge for the coach to develop questions. I try to develop questions ahead of time and scaffold them according to Bloom, and then the interjection of whatever the topic is of discussion, and now that I have the information in reference to these different styles, behavioral styles, then making that connection with the style of asking questions and how the questions would build upon each other according to the behavior style, but I have to be careful of my own style so that I'm not too,
Yes. The second time I'm going to have to move on. If you guys want to have more discussion outside of class on this, we can do that. But I've got another call, this call in, so I need to move along here.
Okay.
Let's talk to the high I, same kind of concepts. At their best, they're upbeat. They're energetic. They are master communicators who can keep you enthralled for hours with their stories. They can sell ice to the Eskimos, as they say. Like the high D, they are natural leaders. They have high energy that is contagious and exciting to people around them. They tend to be quick to smile, quick with a joke, always looking to have fun, either at work or away from work. They have good instincts about people and surround themselves with people who are anxious to make a difference. Their natural charm and powers of persuasion make them peacemakers at home or at the office. They like to go out and have a good time, and they find themselves the center of attention, and they find that everyone knows who they are quickly. And I should say differently, when they go to a place where no one knows who they are, they quickly make friends and become the center of attention. Let's talk about a client here who's a high I. This is, again, high I at their best. Susie seems to have found a home in marketing and advertising. She's full of creative ideas, makes good connections with her customers, and loves the flexibility and travel that comes with her new job. Her work is unstructured, which fits her personality perfectly. It often consists of working with a team of creative people, working around their creative space together, bouncing ideas off each other. But being a manager, there's always paperwork that has to get done. And she can either recharge her batteries, maybe with friends after work for a few drinks. But why is she coming to a coach? That paperwork, managing the budgets, all these projects is not her strength. And that project-by-project cost analysis that accounting wants, yeah. She had to wait until she's in the right mood for that because it doesn't want something she wants to do on a regular basis. Doesn't like the paperwork, interferes with her creativity. And, you know, life is good. So last night she made three new best friends. So that is a high I at their best. Fun to be around, exciting, enjoyable, don't like paperwork, don't like details. So if they're smart, they're going to offload those things on someone else, make sure they get done right. And that's how you begin to coach them. Now, same time, though, there's also the other side of the high eye at their worst. At their worst, they come across as unorganized, unfocused, and more than a little bit shallow. While their stories are amusing, they often seem to center around the high eye themselves. Other people in the story are play lesser, very unimportant roles. Their work can be haphazard because they don't routinely follow up on the assignments they've given to people unless they're reminded to do so. Their overwhelming optimism leads to unrealistic and unachievable goals. They trust their employees to do the right thing without any regard to the employee's skill level. They are slow to acknowledge hiring mistakes because of their unshakable faith in people. Again, that same high I, but an entirely different take on it. So in this case, your client is Frank, and Frank is excited about his new job in network planning, because he knows that network planning, he gets to rub elbows with all the top executives of the company and make regular presentations to them at least on a monthly basis. Great chance to make some new allies and friends. Now, when he got to his new job, he got rid of all those old network maps all over the wall because, you know, they were, you know, boring, replace them with pictures of him and his friends and the various awards he's received. As far as he's concerned, the engineers, they can worry about the maps. That's not what's for him. He spent most of the morning this morning planning a vacation to Mexico with a bunch of his friends. They're going to have a great time together. Now, this afternoon he has to be on this boring conference call, but figures that while he's doing that, he can do his Facebook page at the same time. So what's Frank's challenge? Well, making those presentations, he doesn't want to get too many detailed questions because he can't answer them. He has so many hours at work before his personal life takes over. And corporate will let him find those engineers with him to those big conferences to answer questions. that's okay. He figures he'll just wing it and be okay. So here you have the wrong guy in the wrong job. It's in a very detailed, very technical organization, network planning, and doesn't care about the details, doesn't care about the networks, and just wants to glib his way through it. That's going to be a challenging coaching assignment for somebody. But again, the same high I, different perspective on it. Now, if you're a high I and you're a coach, things you want to watch for as well. You may not want to challenge your client to do more. And so you tend, the coaches who are high tend to accept things and say, well, that's really good, where their client really could be doing more. A high I coach might be tempted to tell personal stories to make a point rather than using the questions to dig deeper. They may end up chatting with a client rather than actually coaching them. They also may ask long, involved questions because they tend to talk and communicate a lot. Again, that's part of your reading here. And they may not be aware how much they are talking, how much they are really listening. Now, can high eyes be great coaches? Absolutely. Absolutely. Anybody who's aware of their tendencies from any of the four styles can be a great coach. High eyes tend to be very likable, so people like calling them. They have the challenges they have to think about as well as they coach and make themselves better coaches. So what about the high I as a client? Well, the natural strength of a high I as a client is that they're going to be optimistic and upbeat. I've got one now that calls me. Every call starts off with, I say, how you doing? He goes, if I was any better, I'd be twins. Or some variation of that high optimism. It doesn't matter how he really thinks. That's how he comes across. And he's very open during the session. So asking questions that pry to dig deeper into the coachable moment, easy, because he's willing to be open with me and tell me. Very open that way. What are his blind spots? Well, overly optimistic. Okay. So he thinks he can get things done in faster time frames. Everything's going to be okay. And he doesn't always take the action steps. They tend to be more talk than action. So for the high I, the accountability role I play as a coach, very important. Every time we talk, we check in and say, okay, so you hear your actions from last time. Did those things get done? And you got to be direct about those kind of things with a high I. Because you may get back as a story rather than a confirmation of what really happened. Okay? As they interact with others, high I's tend to avoid conflict. We hear about issues and challenges, and they'll tell you that they went after the person and talked to them about it. And you dig deeper and get into the detail of the discussion, you may find that the person on the other end might not have understood how important this thing was to the high I, because they tend to avoid the conflict and therefore use verbiage that doesn't get to the point. In some of the answers to questions, a high I client might go off in the weeds with a response. And Cleveland was in my coaching class, and he knows that, I've talked about the fact that if I ask a question and I get the client goes off in the weeds, I ask the very same question again. And if they say, well, didn't you just ask me that? I'll say, yeah. I just need to get a better answer from them. And got to get them back in focus. Some of the challenges of the high I, they have too many number one priorities. They'll tell you everything's important. I once had a client, he's not a client right now, he was a client. He talked a bit about his priorities for his team. And I said, no, what are the priorities? He said, I'll send them to you. It was a 6-page document. Had 140 priorities on it. I said, which is your most important? He goes, they're all important. And that was his view. They were all equally as important. And the old saying is, when everything's a priority, nothing's a priority. That's how he was reacting to him. There was nothing really a priority. They don't understand how people always sometimes perceive them. Again, especially when they're at their worst, they may not be aware of the fact they're coming across as unfocused and scattered. They also have a need to talk, which can make really coaching easy sometimes, because at a classic coaching discussion, you know, the client's really coaching themselves. And a good high-high client, they coach themselves right through an entire session with very little input from the coach, because they'll ask and answer their own questions. That need to talk can be a challenge, but also can be a benefit. Questions you want to ask a high I? Well, how does this make you feel? That's important to them. They need to feel good about it. If you've got a solution they don't feel good about, it likely won't get implemented. They got to find a solution that they like and that they're comfortable with. Move forward. Asking also, what could go wrong here? Again, natural optimists, you think about the downsides. What might go wrong? And the answer is, nothing can go wrong. Time to ask more questions, because something can always go wrong. Make them think about that. Does it matter what others think? Great question to ask a high I. They tend to be focused on what others think about that. And sometimes, especially in leadership roles, it's important to know what they think, but they have to make sure that they know what's going on and, you know, understand the importance of their thoughts versus others. They may know things others do not. When can you realistically accomplish this? Yeah, realism is not a natural tendency of the high I, natural optimists. So again, like the D's, they may sit there and say, I'll do it tomorrow, when tomorrow may not be the appropriate time for it based on what has to get done. And how we know if it worked? The great question for a high I, because like the high D, they may assume that their plan is going to work and not have a way to be able to actually measure and say, yeah, it worked because it did this, and that's what I needed it to do. Therefore, I can move on. So that's the high D and the high I in a nutshell. You had, of course, more in depth in your reading for the session. What kind of questions you have about the high D or the high I, though? No?
Dave, is it possible for the high I to be a leader?
To be a leader?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the D's and the I's tend to be natural leaders in most organizations. The D's because of results, the I's because they get people excited to follow. People like to follow I's because they see them as charismatic and they want to get behind them.
Okay.
So yeah, I's are very natural leaders in an organization. Other questions?
Dave, have you ever coached someone that's changed into another quadrant?
Well, you don't really change quadrants as much as they adapt themselves. When anyone realizes natural strengths and weaknesses, that's part of what coaching is all about. They begin to adapt. So they don't change quadrants. That's not entirely true. Let me say it a different way. If people change quadrants, it's generally not permanent, generally temporary. As in, I'm a natural high I. I've been placed in this accounting position because there was something there that needed to be done and my boss wanted me to do it, and I can focus and concentrate for periods of time to do this kind of work, but I don't really enjoy it. And what you'll see, and if you read the assessments closely, you'll see the discomfort of their job versus what their natural style is. And that discomfort is fine in the short term, but it's not a good solution long term. To give you a real life example of that, going back 6-7 years ago, working with an organization, and I was hired because the CEO said, "We got a great team here, but we're not hitting on all cylinders, and I'm not sure why." And they all took a DISC assessment, and they gave them all to me. And as we were talking as a group the first time through, CEO was again saying, "We got a great team here, just, you know, not everything's not quite right yet. We got to figure out what's not quite right. Keeps us from really excelling. We're good, we're not great." And over the course of the discussion, and I can't give you a blow by blow, it would take way too long, but I finally turned to one of the VPs and said, "So, John, how long have you hated your job?" And the CEO literally stopped me and said, wait a minute. He didn't hate his job. He loves his job. He's great at his job. I look back at the guy and he goes, "Well, I've hated it from the beginning. I'm doing it because I know it needs to get done and I know I could get it done, but I don't like it. I hate this job. I can't wait to get out of it, but I'm doing the best I can." The CEO was stunned. And I said, "And Judy, how about you? How long have you hated your job?" She laughed and said, "Same thing from the beginning, but I'm doing it because I know it has to get done and I'm trying to help the team here." So good people, talented people, smart people, wrong seat on the bus, doing the best they can, but their natural style was contrary to the job they were given. Detail-oriented person put in a job where they have to be highly creative, doesn't fit. They try their best, they struggle, and it causes stress. Person who's got a lot of outgoing energy, forces a lot of detail work, they can do it, but it causes a lot of stress for them. So that's why once you read the profiles, you'll start to see and recognize some of the stressors involved, and you'll be able to see where people are sometimes stressed because they're in the wrong spot.
Well, I wonder, and that was a great example, someone just owning up to their maturity as being part of the team and said, "I may not like it, but it's got to be done and I do it." I'm also thinking of the person who, you know, develops into a different quadrant. For the example, somebody who's shy and would probably be in the lower quadrant, let's say, but all of a sudden embraces sales and very outgoing and all of a sudden becomes a great public speaker just through, you know, nature and nurture and development.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, you know, I understand that we all have our natural tendencies, but I'm just wondering if out of those natural tendencies we do gravitate to other quadrants just as a result of association or experiencing new skills or jobs or whatever.
You'll get someone who's a high C or a high S who will be a phenomenal, use your example, public speaker, engaging, fun to be around, and they're naturally thoughtful, reserved. But what they tend to do then when they finish the session, they tend to sit there and say, "Okay, I can turn that off now," and they tend to go into more seclusion to recharge their batteries. So they can display the other qualities, because then they can revel in them periods of time before they need to recharge. There are some things that are core to our personalities that can be changed, but more likely you're going to adapt to other styles than change your own. So
Dave, is permanent. Dave, is that something that we talked about last week in reference to some of the profiles that have like a shading that's like striped and goes into other quadrants?
So that could be part of it, yeah, because that's something they could have learned. For example, a high I, therefore is not going to be very detail-oriented, but whose parents or whose first boss or first job, whatever, was very detail-oriented, they could learn that. And that's more of a long-term thing, though. It can be long-term or it can be temporary. You have to kind of see if that's at the top of the person, where it really fits.
Yeah.
But those strong tendencies like that, when they're permanent, when you got a high I, for example, using an example, a high I with a very strong C and it's permanent, some people sit there and say, well, that just seems weird. Actually, enormously powerful. Have someone who's that outgoing and that exciting and that much of a leader who also can focus on details, that is powerful. They're rare. They're powerful. Okay. We'll get the recording posted to the website again within a day or so here, and I'll get things out to you for our session 3. We're going to be discussing the S and the C behavioral styles next week. And they're equally fun to play with as the D's and the I's are.
Oh, yeah.
Okay?
Yes.
All right. Everybody have a great week.
Thank you.
Talk to you all next week.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye, guys.